Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Studio G, the discussions for women in leadership. Actually, anybody in leadership, right? Sometimes we get stuck on saying that. I don't know why, but we always start the show the same we started it a year ago. But we are open to everybody in leadership this evening, and glad that you have joined us back here to discuss the Omega Leadership Principles, as defined by Lori Beth Jones in her book, Jesus CEO. With us in the studio this evening, we have herself, Lori Beth Jones. Welcome, Lori Beth.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And we have Elisa Holston representing the Education Pillar. Welcome, Elisa.
Good evening. It's great to be here.
And we have Vicky Arteaga representing the Business Pillar. Hello, how are you doing? We all just had a great feast before the show, so if we're a little bit lethargic this evening, you'll know why. Nevertheless, we are here on Friday evening this week to talk about the Omega Leader instead of Thursday, because Lori Beth was traveling yesterday, and it just did not work out. So we are here this evening. And if you are listening to this show for the first time, we welcome you to the show. And if you are returning to hear more about the leadership principles and the leadership styles of an Omega Leader, we are indeed glad that you are still following this discussion, because every week it is kind of a new experience, right, where we come together and we talk about these principles and share with each other. And we're just excited to be here, and so we're going to open up this evening's show in just a couple of minutes with Lori Beth to talk about this section on passion. We are still in looking at, in Jesus in Blue Jeans, the leader as the spiritual guide or the spiritual disciple, how that looks. And in the section of passion, we're talking how Jesus cleared the altar and also how he, somebody help me here?
Went looking for what was lost.
So, Lori, would you like to open us this evening and tell us a little bit about your thoughts around these two concepts of leadership as we're looking at principles of passion that a leader displays?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that we are all grateful that Vicky Arteaga is still with us.
Yes.
After swallowing a chip that went round, down the wrong way.
Yes,
it was...
famous last words. Fuck you, this
shit. So that was very painful. But here we are, and the topic is, he kept his altar clean. In the book, I talk about the fact that I always have a drop zone wherever I live, and most people do. In fact, when they're designing houses now, they always ask the owners, when you walk in, where do you put your keys? Where do you put things for your pocket? I know my dad had, beside his bed, he always had his change and stick of gum or whatever when his was in his pocket. And it occurred to me that our altars get cluttered very easily because so often we use them as a drop zone, in that we don't clear a space for God in our hearts and minds and souls. So with that as a preamble, I know that there are very intelligent questions sitting here, and I'll let Vicky rest her little throat a little bit more. Ure, what questions do you have, or what do you want to talk about? I have a two-part question. Shelley, would you like to ask your question first?
No. I have a two-part question here. First of all, what are some of the common altars that we have, or the common things that we tend to put on our altars, distractions?
Well, I think that's what I want to talk about, is what are the altars? I think for me, the distraction is I'm too busy to start my day with thinking about God. I have the altar of checking the news in the morning. Like it will have changed so majorly overnight. And I probably need to do a media fast, but I think it's very easy to, you know, we like to stay current on events. So for me, one of the things that's on my altar that I need to keep clear is thinking that current events are more prevalent or more predominantly important than my time with God.
Part of that is, and I guess I just have to ask it, that I wondered if, like, for you it's the news, and for different people it's different things. Is there any correlation, perhaps, with the elements as to what some of those distractions may be?
What is it for me?
I think for me, I get distracted with anything other than what I'm supposed to be doing.
Oh, funny.
I usually get distracted with music and and sports. You know, if there's something going on, that's where my mind goes. So for you in the morning, this is the news. Sometimes on purpose, I do my quiet times in the morning, so on purpose I don't turn the TV on till I have had my quiet time. Otherwise, yeah, it's a distraction and that. How about you, Shelley?
Well, you know, I just don't think I have any distractions.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, people. People are a huge distraction. You know, I don't know. Probably for me it's busyness, always busy, always doing something or thinking or, you know, creating or designing or processing. Yeah. So I would say, you know, it's an altar of busyness, and that gets cluttered very quickly.
I think, too, that success, the desire for success, is something that goes on my altar. I want to win. I'm not so much that way anymore, but it used to be, what can I do that's going to get ahead, you know, get ahead financially, not necessarily ahead of someone else, but ahead of my goals. And I think in our culture, it's very easy to put things on the altar and make them the goal. For example, prosperity. And, you know, looking better than someone else. So, but with a fire, I find that interesting that you are a procrastinator.
I am.
So.
Let me think about that. I'll get back to you on that.
Maybe tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Maybe tomorrow.
Where did the concept, Lori Beth, do you think the first altar happened, the first altar occurred, first place of sacrifice?
I remember it. But it had to do, it's really about remembrance. So an altar is a place of remembrance of a moment of connecting with God, as well as a place of worship. And it also used to be used for sacrifices, which is horrible to think about. And I don't know where that concept even came from. But we had the privilege of meeting with a young photographer yesterday at Biola University, Shannon Leith, who does amazing photography, and we were working with her on her mission statement, and her core value was finding the sacred moment.
Mm-hmm.
And she did a whole series on just her dishes, you know, the dishes in her sink, the dishes when they're washed, and it reminded me of, I guess it was some Brother Lawrence or somebody did a whole series on, he worked in the kitchen at a monastery, and he found God in everyday things,
right,
in the kitchen. And so she was talking about how with weddings, that she doesn't want to do just the typical wedding photography. She wants to find something that is sacred in the moment. And she's got a waiting list now of people are delaying their weddings so that she can take pictures. And then she's starting to do a class with young kids about seeing the light,
mm-hmm.
that photography and creative expression is a way to express the light, and that everything is a sacred moment. So I think that in our busyness and in our procrastination and our desire for the news and looking at sports and all those things, we lose the sacred moment of now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, speaking of wedding photography, photography is my hobby as well. And when I was working at the Women's Resource Center, one of my coworkers decided to get married in a civil ceremony and invited me to come do the photography. And it was just at the judge's, you know, just in front of a judge's very, very small wedding. So I took my camera and took a bunch of pictures and then developed the film, and I was so pleased with what I took her, because there was the light coming in through the windows, and there were the hands, and then there were the purses on the floor of the people who were the witnesses, and somehow I had forgotten to take a picture of the bride and the groom. So, yep, so that was worth everything she paid me. Which was nothing. I'm here to say nothing. So who has further thoughts on the altar?
Lisa has a thought. Okay, I think the description you just gave of the wedding is true, I think, in a lot of things, is that sometimes the things that we put on an altar aren't necessarily bad things. Like your artistic shots weren't bad things. They were beautiful artistic shots. They were just misplaced for that context or that time, you know. And so I guess the question is, how can we discriminate, you know? So taking a picture of the light coming through the window, taking the picture of their hands is a beautiful thing. How can we discriminate? And so it was maybe it wasn't the best idea in the time and the context, or maybe it wasn't the best thing because the absence of the essential. So how can we discriminate what some of the distractions or things on our altar might not be bad things, but how can we discriminate when they become a distraction from what we should be worshiping and focusing on?
Well, the chapter that follows this one, which we're not really scheduled to talk about, but it's actually one of my favorite chapters, relates to this, and it's called Do the Thing and Let Them Howl. And it stems from a conversation I had with a good friend, and she was saying, she's very involved in showers and all sorts of things in the valley, and she said, someone wants to have a shower at my house, and I just don't think I really want it because it's too busy and all this other stuff. And I said, what if you say no? And she said, oh, they'll really howl. And I said, and what if you say yes? She said, well, there's other people who want the house, and they're going to howl too. And I said, what do you really want? She said, I want a peaceful day in my home. And I said, so people are going to howl whether no matter what. So do the thing that you need and let them howl. And I think that popularity is something that, as a wind, I often put on the altar, that I want to be liked. And I don't want anybody to howl at me.
And as you said, it could be good things. Like, for example, how many of us have had altars in the church work?
Yeah.
Right? We take on a ministry, or we take on something that is a ministry, and then suddenly it becomes more important what we're doing than why we're doing it. And really have the clean altar for him. So we, in ministry, is also, and we have to be careful.
Texting.
I have a question about, you know, what are the, do we even use altars anymore? You know, in synagogues or temples, I mean, when's the last time you guys went to the altar and you really laid something on it? So we're talking figuratively here, right, Lori?
No, there's a lot of churches. I was just in a church last week that had an altar.
Right. But, I mean, in the context that we've been talking about it tonight, the things that we're placing on the altar, where is that? It's a figurative altar, right?
Right.
So if it's a literal altar, wow, I have to stop and think, when's the last time that I literally went? And if we're talking about the passion of an Omega leader, having the insight to lead people to discover what's on their altar, how do we do that? How do we demonstrate that? If in the seeker service that there's no place for the altar call.
Oh,
is this a WikiLeak?
Is this a WikiLeak? Yes, I come to the altar alone.
The garden.
I come to the altar in the garden. So maybe we should talk about secret places, because the altar was a secret place. You know, in Leviticus, people who were deformed could not approach the altar. There were so many rules of who could even approach the altar. And I think
so
Jesus opened that up.
Where can we, how do we do that as leaders? If we're talking about Omega leadership, knowing how to clear the altar,
what is that altar that we're talking about?
Is it the kitchen table? You know,
is it the comfy chair, you know, in the corner? You know, is it the favorite seat in the theater? You know, where is this contemporary place that we call altar? And how do people find the altar if there's clutter all over the place?
Yeah, you know, I had a related question too. Is that how can leaders keep their teams from from cluttering their altars? You know, so first, obviously, Shelley's question is great. What is the altar, right? What is the altar for your team, your organization, your pillar? What is that, you know, in terms of maybe it's related to your mission? And then how can the Omega leader help her team keep it free of clutter once you figure out where it is and what it is?
I think it has to do with clarity about the mission. And the CEOs, one of the CEOs that I'm working with, he's just adamant that everybody be able to state the mission, which is to reach, serve, and teach. And so anything that comes up, he asks, does this help us reach, serve, and teach? And recently, someone on the board suggested that they launch this academy, which I knew was going to be very time-consuming and expensive. And frankly, I argued against it. And he said, look, we need to teach. That's in our mission statement. So we're going to do it. We're going to find a way to do it. And he just swept all of my practical concerns, which the staff themselves were echoing, but it was like he swept that off and he said, we teach. Mm-hmm. We need to teach. And we're going to teach. So, yeah, I think it is powerful.
So the Omega leader doesn't worry about keeping it from getting cluttered, but the Omega leader maybe just sweeps it off when it gets too cluttered.
It's powerful.
Maybe so.
Yeah,
that's a great point. Well, let's jump into the next segment here, Lori Beth. Lead us into how the Omega leader looks for what is lost. What were your thoughts as you were writing that piece about leadership?
Ezekiel 34 is a very powerful memo from God to the shepherds, and he is furious. And he says, you wear the finest clothes, you eat the finest meat, nobody has gone looking for what is lost. You do not bind up the sick, you are not doing your job. And then he continues and he said, I will hold you accountable for what has happened to my flock. So in Jesus, there were so many stories. The widow who lost the coin, the father who was waiting for his son who was lost, the shepherd who was looking for the lost sheep. He understood that search is a human need. Because we lose things, and we're looking for what was lost. So the Omega leader goes looking for what is lost. And some of that is knowing what values have we lost, what is missing in our agenda and the way we treat each other. So I think it's important to understand that part of our job as shepherdesses is to go looking for what's missing, not just glory in what we have.
And it might be that what is lost is time out, time to take a step back to gain perspective, because of the busyness and everybody pushing for goals, and things that, you know, it's a time to reflect. Another thing that might be lost is recognizing the employees. You know, the things that we might take for granted, or what was the first love of the business, or, you know, why this business? Why not something else? If you just keep doing, and not knowing the why, then you lost your compass. you lost your the sense of I'm thinking in Spanish now. Perspectiva, yeah, perspective. You know, you lost your perspective. You're like in the middle of nowhere.
I think one of the biggest challenges is knowing that something is lost. I think we can, you know, I was sharing tonight as we were having dinner about, you know, my school is going through a restructuring process, and it began its very painful process because the very first session was looking in the mirror and realizing what had been lost and how easy and comfortable it was to go for such a long period of time and lose perspective, as Vicki said, lose sight of what had been lost. So how can an Omega leader know what is lost, or how can we keep from losing sight of what can become lost?
So I think it has to do with staying centered and also staying at the altar, staying in prayer. And there's a powerful story in the chapter that I want to talk about, but right now I want to go around the table and ask, when do you remember losing something of value, and how diligently did you search for it? Who wants to go first?
I'll go first because it's not really that valuable, but for the last several weeks it's starting to get colder outside, and I've been looking for some gloves that I know I have somewhere. But I cannot find these gloves, and I'm just like, it's like taking up some kind of space on my hard drive. You know, I think about it like I'm getting ready to put my jacket on, and the gloves aren't there. And so, you know, as I prepared for this evening, thinking about, you know, how simple that is. You know, it's so just a material piece of cloth, but how I remember having it. I remember how it felt to have them on my hands. And I thought I remembered where I placed them. And so I think sometimes in leadership, we forget the sense of what it was like to be found. And in leadership, we forget the sense of what it feels like to be worn when it's found. And then in leadership, sometimes we forget to keep looking for what is lost, because we're on the strategic path, we're on the projected path, we're on the targeted goal. You know, we're after the 99 that are not standing in front of us instead of the one that's knocking at the door.
That was beautiful, Shelley. What have you lost?
I lose things on a regular basis.
Every day, yeah?
Every day, yes. Everybody's nodding their heads. The most recent thing of value I lost, I have a rental property, was the rent check from my tenant. But I did find it. But I did spend 24 hours in a panic mode about where did I set that check. And so, yeah, it creates a sense of anxiety and panic, you know. And my problem is I think I put it in a safe place and that I don't remember what that safe place was. So I do. I lose track of things quite often that are of value and then suffer great anxiety as a result.
So I'm a little the contrary of Elisa. I usually know exactly where I left things and all that, so it's not easy for me to lose things. And when I do it, it's the end of the world. I'm like, it has to be here. It has to be here. So it really paralyzes me in a sense that I think I'm hard on myself. How could you lose that? How could you do that? And, you know, I don't know if it's because we get complacent or because we get worried too much about what we lost, then we stop looking for it. It's more the concern about what we have lost than, okay, well, move, look for it, you know. Get the action to find it, to see. And maybe action could be being in line with God, or being treasure where was I and what did I do, you know, in case of objects, or in case of values, or in case of, you know, where was I when it was the last time that I
felt that.
Or a friend, you know. How many of us keep friends for years and years and years?
Yeah, so it depends on the value of something, right? How long we look for it.
In this chapter, I talk about going to Pompeii for the first time on a tour. And there were signs out that said, please do not touch the dogs. So we got off the bus and we were entering this amazing space. And all I could notice, there must have been 80 dogs ranging through Pompeii. And they were diseased and hungry and mangy, and all I could think about was these dogs. I couldn't even appreciate, you know, the magnitude of the space that we were in. It was like, doesn't anybody care about these dogs? And at the time, now I know now they've changed that, but at the time, there was no Humane Society in Pompeii, so it was like the dogs are on their own, and that's all there is to it. And I just thought, that is so pathetic. And then I was talking about it on the bus to someone who happened to be Italian. And she looked at me and she said, well, we may treat our dogs that way, but in America you treat people that way. Because the first time I went to America and went to New York, I was appalled to see homeless people. We had to step over homeless people to get to the Broadway play. And it wasn't an adversarial conversation. It was an awakening. Because I myself step over homeless people to go to the mall. I mean, and that's literal. I'm not being literal about that. But in America, we've gotten used to seeing homeless people. In Europe, it's quite rare. So we care about our dogs. Yes, well, we care about our dogs. I mean, we make sure that the dogs aren't roaming the streets, but the people can. And in Italy, it's a different value. So I think one of the things we have lost is the sensitivity to the human condition.
Yeah, both of these chapters, we just have about 3 minutes left, Lori Beth, but both of these chapters are significant calls to, you know, to the human behavior, what's on our altar, and what is lost that we're searching for. And I think all of us would agree in our day and time and in our society there is a sense of loss over wars, over, you know, natural disasters. There's constantly, we turn on the news, there's some kind of loss happening. And maybe we're not as sensitive to it because it's not happening to us. And so I think both of these chapters cause us to pause in our leadership. And are we being sensitive in most cases of things that are going on, that someone is lost? I probably would be the first to say no. But if we're talking about leadership and how that shows up and how that affects other people, then this is a call to action. How are we keeping our altar, and where is that altar? And how are we searching for what is lost?
Well, the story I want to close with in the chapter on He Went Looking for What Was Lost, I attended the State of the World Forum several years ago and actually met a Catholic Buddhist. And there was a fascinating group of people there. I was actually on a panel with Gorbachev. It was an amazing event. And so I was talking to him about Cambodia. And he said that, I said, how did you end up in Cambodia? Because he'd been a Catholic priest. And he said, well, I was there helping, and this woman, in the rush of the refugees to get to the boats, this woman was separated from her two-year-old daughter, and she was just hysterical and crying and weeping. And she was on the boat, and she couldn't find her daughter anywhere. And she handed a picture to me, and she said, please find my daughter. She couldn't even get off the boat, so somehow they made this transition. And she just gave him the picture. And he told her, he said, go. He said, I will find your daughter. And he said, I found her. And I said, how did you find her? And he said, I went walking village to village with the picture of the daughter. I said, how long did it take? He said, 2 years. I said, what about your other job? He looked at me and he said, that was my job. The Omega leader goes looking for what has been lost.
Thank you, Omega. Thank you, everyone. Talk to you next week.
Good night.